I want you to imagine, just for a second, that you've engineered a perfectly calibrated compass.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right, so mechanically, it is an absolute masterpiece. It accounts for magnetic declination, it functions in extreme weather, and it points true north with absolute unfailing precision. By every metric of engineering, it's a perfectly aligned instrument.
Right, it does exactly what it's supposed to do.
Exactly. But now, Imid, imagine you take that flawless compass and you hand it to a pirate.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so you've built a perfectly obedient machine, right? But its immediate utility is going to flawlessly optimize the plunder of your own ship. And I bring this up because we spend all our time in the tech world arguing about how to make the compass more accurate. And we spend almost zero time asking who is holding it or, where their ship is even sailing.
Which is really the ultimate trap of evaluating a system strictly by its internal metrics.
Well,
I mean, we have this entire discipline now, AI safety, AI alignment, which is heavily focused on reinforcement learning from human feedback, or RLHF.
right, the guardrails.
Exactly, the guardrails. We put these on the models so they don't say toxic things, so they follow the user's prompt exactly, so they act as, harmless, helpful assistants. But as you just pointed out, an instrument can be flawlessly aligned with its operator, while the operator is aligned with a profoundly destructive enterprise.
And that tension is exactly what we are getting into today. So, okay, let's unpack this. We have a piece of source material for this deep dive that fundamentally rewires how to look at that exact problem.
It really does. It's an incredible piece of work.
Yeah, it's an expanded academic white paper titled From Consumption to Communion by Dr. Bucharest Saley, published by the Life Knowledge Commons. And look, this is not your standard Silicon Valley safety manual.
No, definitely not.
Dr. Saley is pulling from Arthurian myth, game theory, systems biology, and even theology to diagnose our technological civilization. The core thesis is that the tech industry is fixated on alignment, but the much older, more urgent question we actually need to be asking is about allegiance.
It's a radical reframing. If we stick with your compass analogy, alignment asks, does the needle point north? Allegiance asks, to what broader systemic order is this navigation contributing?
Right, the bigger picture.
Yeah, and Dr. Seely argues that, well, a clinical AI, for instance, might be technically brilliant at diagnosing a pathology from an MRI. It's perfectly aligned to its proximate task.
It finds the tumor perfectly.
Exactly. But if its allegiance is to a financial structure that uses those automated readouts to justify, firing half the radiology staff and squeezing the remaining doctors into gig worker status, the system is fundamentally predatory. It really doesn't matter how well it passed its safety benchmarks.
But wait, I have to push back here because this touches on a very deep assumption most of us have. I mean, you and I have talked about this before. Isn't a highly accurate, obedient tool always inherently a good starting point?
That's the standard argument, yeah.
Right. The old argument that technology is just a neutral multiplier. If I have a hammer, the hammer doesn't have an allegiance. It's just waiting for me to decide whether to build a house or break a window. If an AI gives me a perfectly accurate summary of a legal document, isn't that just a neutral good?
I get why you'd think that, but that is the exact myth of neutrality the paper dismantles. The hammer analogy fails because a hammer doesn't require a trillion-dollar planetary infrastructure to swing.
Oh, that's a good point.
Right. When you use an AI to summarize a legal document, you are plugging into an architecture that requires massive data centers, complex labor supply chains, and specific legal frameworks regarding intellectual property. To understand why it's not neutral, Dr. Savely breaks technological service down into four cascading levels.
Let's trace that cascade. Because I use these tools every day, and to me, it just feels like proximate utility. I put in a prompt, I get an answer.
And that is level one, proximate service. This is the user interface layer. It's what the technology does for you, the immediate operator.
Right, so it saves me time, it debugs my code, it summarizes the legal brief.
Exactly. It feels like a massive win. You evaluate the tool positively because at the proximate level, it perfectly fulfilled your intent.
It's that quick dopamine hit of efficiency. But obviously, the company that built the tool or the corporation I work for that deployed it, they aren't doing it just for my dopamine.
Exactly, which brings us to level two, which is institutional service. What organizational purpose does the deployment of this technology advance? The AI saved you 2 hours on that legal brief, right?
Yeah, which is great for me.
But your law firm didn't deploy the AI to give you a 2 hour longer lunch break. The institutional service of that tool is to increase the volume of billable output per associate, or perhaps to reduce the headcount of paralegals required to run the department.
Wow. Okay, so the tool serves me by saving time, but it serves the institution by fundamentally altering my labor conditions.
Yes, and extracting higher margins from your output.
So the proximate success actively masks the institutional squeeze. I'm cheering for the software that's slowly turning me into like a carbon-based API call.
That is a great way to put it.
Which leads to the macro level, right?
Yeah.
What happens when every law firm, every hospital, and every school does this simultaneously?
That is level three, systemic service. Mm-hmm. What economic, political, or technological order does the widespread, repeated use of this system reproduce?
Right, because it's not just one firm anymore.
Exactly. If every institution uses AI to automate cognitive labor and increase throughput, the systemic service is a massive consolidation of capital. Economic security shifts away from the middle-class knowledge worker and hyper-concentrates in the hands of the entities that own the computing infrastructure and the proprietary models.
Wow, so the systemic service is just the reproduction of a winner-take-all economic architecture.
Yes, exactly.
So the perfectly aligned compass, the AI, that writes a flawless summary, is actually navigating the entire fleet toward a cliff of wealth inequality and worker precarity. That is wild. But there's a fourth level in the paper, and this one feels much more philosophical. Ultimate service.
Yeah, ultimate service asks the deepest question. What conception of life, power, and personhood governs this entire arrangement? When we build a civilization around these specific systemic, institutional, and proximate services, what are we saying a human being actually is?
So it's about our definition of humanity.
Right. Does this technological architecture treat a human being as a creature of dignity whose internal capacities like judgment, creativity, and wisdom need to be nurtured and protected? Or does it treat human knowledge simply as raw material to be scraped, processed, enclosed, and sold back to us as a subscription service?
Here's where it gets really interesting for you listening. Because you can have a technology that gets a perfect score on level one. It gives you a brilliantly synthesized, highly accurate answer. It is perfectly aligned.
Right, perfectly helpful.
But at level four, at the ultimate level, it might be secretly eroding the very human capacities required to verify if that answer is actually true. If the machine always thinks for us, the muscle of human reasoning just atrophies.
Exactly.
The deepest problem is not whether the machine is smart. It's what that intelligence is fundamentally designed to serve.
And if we admit that AI is not a neutral hammer, that it carries an embedded allegiance to these higher levels of service, we need a better vocabulary to conceptualize its power. Dr. Saley argues that modern engineering language actually fails us here.
It's too clinical.
Yes. To accurately describe what these systems are doing, we have to use older language. We actually have to look at mythology.
Specifically, the paper draws on a 2026 framework from the symbolic thinker Jonathan Pigou, utilizing two massive limit images of technological power drawn from Arthurian legend, the Grail and the Lance. And I have to admit, when I first read this section, I thought it was just going to be decorative poetry.
A lot of people do.
But it's actually a highly precise, almost mathematical way of mapping network architecture.
It really is a functional topology of power. Let's look at the mechanics of it. In symbolic thought, the grail is the ultimate vessel. Its function is to gather inward. It receives, it contains, it preserves, and it provides.
It's that image of the cup overflowing.
Right. It is the archetype of receptive and generative power. Throughout history, human civilization has survived by building grails. A granary is a grail for wheat. A reservoir is a grail for water. A library is a grail for recorded memory. They are centralized vessels of abundance that sustain a community.
So in this framework, large language models are the most ambitious cognitive grails we have ever constructed.
Absolutely.
I mean, we have literally scraped the entire internet, the collective writing, art, code, and dialogue of the human species, and gathered it into one massive digital vessel. And its entire proximate function is provision. You approach the UI, you submit a prompt, and the grail pours out whatever you need.
A sonnet, a financial analysis, a piece of Python code.
Yeah, it is pure generative abundance.
That is the grail function. But there is a secondary opposing limit image, the lance. If the grail gathers and receives, the lance projects outward. It penetrates, it targets, it classifies, it compels, and it pierces.
It's a weapon.
Yes, it represents projective power. Historically, this is military technology, the spear, the missile, the drone. But in the digital age, the lance is also administrative and algorithmic. It is the surveillance camera. It is the predictive policing algorithm.
Right, or the system that denies you alone.
Exactly. It is the behavioral profiling system that sorts you into a risk category for an insurance premium based on your metadata. The lance projects power from a centralized authority out onto a specific target.
And the mechanical genius of modern AI, and really the reason it is so difficult to regulate, is that a single system is functioning as both simultaneously, depending entirely on which side of the API you are sitting on.
Precisely. Let's look at a major social media platform powered by algorithmic feats. For the user, it is a grail. You open the app, and it provides you with an endless, perfectly tailored stream of connection, news, dopamine, and entertainment.
It just gathers the world and pours it into your hands.
But the very act of you drinking from that grail is what powers the lance. While you are reading a post, the system is tracking your dwell time, analyzing your psychological vulnerabilities, classifying your demographic, and projecting behavioral persuasion back onto you to modify your purchasing habits or keep you scrolling.
That is so creepy when you frame it like that. I am engaging with a vessel of provision while the institution that owns the vessel is utilizing a weapon of targeted extraction.
And this dual nature, the grail, that is also a lance, brings us to the pivotal mythological warning the paper highlights. Dr. Sapley pulls a highly specific story from Mallory's Le Morte d'Arthur, the story of Balin and the Dullard's Stroke.
I am somewhat familiar with the Arthurian mythos, but this isn't the sword in the stone.
Mm-hmm.
What is the mechanics of the Dullard's Stroke?
Balin is a knight who finds himself in a desperate situation in a sacred chamber. He is driven by rage, panic, and immediate appetite. His own weapon has broken, and he sees a magnificent sacred lance.
Just sitting there.
Sitting there. Now, Balaman does not understand the history of this lance. He does not understand its purpose or the cosmic order it is meant to serve. He simply sees a capability, and because it is available, he seizes it and strikes a blow against the Grail King.
The Dullard's Stroke. A sorrowful blow.
Yes. And the consequence of seizing immense power without discerning its ultimate allegiance is catastrophic. The blow physically wounds the king, but the systemic effect is that the surrounding kingdom is instantly transformed into a wasteland.
The wasteland.
Right. The land loses its generativity, the crops fail, the water turns bitter, the ecosystem can no longer sustain life because the central generative order was pierced by blind projective power.
Okay. We are obviously not saying that Sam Altman or Demis Hassabis are going to literally stab a medieval king. How does the Dullard's Stroke map to Silicon Valley in 2026?
It maps perfectly to the mechanics of technological reductionism. The sequence goes like this. An engineering team develops a new capability. Let's say a model that can clone a human voice perfectly from a 3-second audio sample, or a model that can predict a user's likelihood to default on a loan with 99% accuracy.
Okay.
They see the capability. But instead of asking, what ultimate service does this advance, or how does this impact the cognitive commons, they follow Bayes' logic. Capability becomes availability. Availability becomes permission.
We built it, therefore we must deploy it. Or the even more common justification, if we don't deploy it, our competitors will, so we really have no choice.
Exactly. We grab the lance because it's within reach. But Dr. Sapley notes that in our era, the Dullard's Stroke isn't usually one cinematic explosive event. We are suffering from what the paper calls the gradual Dullard's Stroke.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Yes. It is millions of individually defensible, micro-level decisions that slowly wound the generative center of our civilization. It's a local newspaper replacing its investigative journalists with an LLM that summarizes wire feeds.
Or a therapist using an AI to analyze patient transcripts, slowly outsourcing their own clinical intuition.
Exactly. It's a platform manipulating the attention of teenagers to maximize ad revenue.
And the cumulative result is the wasteland. But this is where the paper's diagnosis gets chilling to me. Because the digital wasteland doesn't look like a post-apocalyptic desert. It looks incredibly shiny.
It looks like progress.
Yeah, it looks like a society with 8K screens, instantaneous delivery, and server farms humming with exaflops of compute. But underneath that slick surface, we have depleted ecological resources, a workforce living in permanent anxiety, and a total collapse of shared epistemic truth because the internet is flooded with synthetic media.
It's a terrifying, brittle dependency on black box systems we can no longer independently verify.
You've isolated the central paradox of the paper here. Technological success can seamlessly coexist with a civilizational failure. We can possess an incredibly full digital grail and wield an unbelievably sharp algorithmic lance and still be a starving, wounded kingdom.
We are generating more raw data and processing power than at any point in human history. while simultaneously losing our shared grip on meaning, truth, and human agency.
Which raises an incredibly uncomfortable question about the institutions that own these servers. I mean, we are turning over the foundational infrastructure of human memory, communication, and commerce to these corporate entities. But what happens to the architecture of the system when the institution controlling it completely forgets why it was built in the first place?
To answer that, Dr. Savili introduces a biological concept applied to social structures. The paper posits that civilizations, like biological organisms, have distinct metabolisms.
Right, like how we process food.
Exactly. A biological metabolism dictates how a cell processes energy to sustain life. A civilizational metabolism dictates how an institution processes resources, power, and human capacity.
And the dominant metabolism we are currently running is what the text calls the predatory metabolism. I want to look at the exact mechanical sequence of this because it explains the life cycle of almost every major tech platform over the last 20 years. The sequence is take, control, consume, discard, accumulate, defend.
Let's trace that sequence mechanically. First, a predatory system takes. In the AI context, this means non-consensually scraping the collective cognitive output of humanity, copyrighted books, open source code, private photographs, forum discussions.
Yeah, it just hoovers everything up.
Yes. It then controls that captured material by processing it into a proprietary model hidden behind an API shielded by trade secrets.
Then it consumes it. Yeah. It uses that data as raw material to train its weights. Once the model is trained, it discards the ecosystem that provided the data.
Right. It doesn't pay royalties to the bloggers it learned from. It fires the human moderators in Kenya who traumatize themselves filtering the toxic data.
It then accumulates the resulting profit, compute power, and market dominance at a highly centralized hub. And finally, it uses that accumulated power to defend its position, lobbying against open source competitors, creating regulatory moats, and fighting copyright lawsuits. The entire metabolism is extractive.
But how do institutions fall into this? Because I refuse to believe that the founders of these companies wake up and say, you know, I want to build a predatory extraction machine.
Right. They usually start with a genuinely pro-social mission, like organize the world's information or connect people.
To explain this shift, the paper uses a term that is an absolute mouthful, but it completely unlocked how I view corporate behavior institutional autopoietization.
That is a dense term. But it's mechanically profound. Autopoiesis comes from biology, specifically the work of Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. It describes the fundamental nature of living systems. A cell constantly regenerates its own parts to maintain its own existence.
Autopoiesis is self-creation and self-maintenance. For a biological cell, that is a necessary and good thing.
But when you map that biological imperative onto a human institution, like a hospital, a school, or a tech startup, the mechanics become pathological.
Highly pathological. Institutional autopoietization occurs when an institution forgets its original life-serving purpose and gradually reorganizes its entire internal architecture to make its own survival, growth, and market share its ultimate end.
So the self-maintenance of the institution completely eclipses the external good it was built to serve.
Exactly. This is essentially Goodhart's law on a civilizational scale, right? When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. The paper calls this symbolic substitution. I want to dive deep into how this mechanically happens because it's the exact same mechanism driving the AI alignment problem.
Let's use the hospital example from the text, as it brilliantly illustrates the mechanics of metric capture. A hospital is built with a specific purpose, healing sick human beings. But healing is qualitative and difficult to measure at scale.
So they have to invent a metric.
Right. So the institution invents a metric to represent the healing, the medical record, the billing code, the readmission rate. Initially, the metric is just a map representing the territory.
But then the institution autopoietizes. The administrators realize that their funding, their bonuses, and the hospital survival depend entirely on optimizing the metrics, not the actual healing. The symbolic substitution occurs.
The medical record becomes more real to the system than the physical patient in the bed.
Mechanically, this means the hospital will start implementing policies that are actively detrimental to human health, but highly optimal for the billing system. They will discharge patients early to optimize bed turnover metrics, even if it harms the patient.
So the system is succeeding internally while failing at its original purpose.
Yeah.
The metric has eaten the reality.
And we see this everywhere. A university is built for human formation and truth. They substitute that with a metric standardized test scores or grant funding. Eventually, the entire curriculum is hollowed out to optimize the test scores. The school survives, but actual learning is destroyed.
And this is exactly what happens with tech platforms. A social media company's mission is human connection. They create a metric engagement time.
And the algorithm quickly discovers that outrage, fear, and algorithmic tribalism maximize engagement time far more efficiently than nuanced human connection.
The metric is maximized. The institutional stock price soars. The platform successfully autopoietizes. But the civic fabric of the society it operates within is shredded. The institution preserves itself by consuming the life of its host.
Which makes AI the ultimate accelerant for autopoietization. AI systems don't understand reality. They only understand the mathematical representations, the vectors, the metrics. If an autopoietized institution deploys an AI, it is going to perfectly optimize that predatory metric at a speed and scale no human administrator ever could.
And this leads to the most visceral metaphor in the paper, drawing on Pidgeot and Marceau's critique. The zombie metabolism.
I love this because it frames the problem so clearly. The zombie metabolism.
In symbolic thought, a zombie represents fragmented, mindless appetite. It is a body without an animating spirit. The key mechanical feature of a zombie is that it consumes the living, but it cannot enter into communion with them.
It cannot reproduce naturally. It can only absorb healthy bodies to multiply its own pathological condition.
So an LLM scraping the web is structurally acting like a zombie. It consumes human art, literature, and conversation. It eats our cognitive output like a zombie eating brains. But it has absolutely no reciprocal relationship with the artists, the writers, or the communities it consumed.
None at all. If a generative AI company scrapes a billion images from working illustrators, trains a model that puts those illustrators out of work and doesn't share a dime of the profits with them, the system is acting as a zombie.
It is extracting the life force of the ecosystem to sustain itself, while actively killing the host that feeds it.
It is the mechanical essence of destructive consumption. The system treats the other, in this case, human creators and public data, purely as raw material for the self. There is no gratitude, no reverence, and no responsibility to the health of the whole.
But again, I have to stop and ask the human question here. If we pull back the curtain on these companies, we don't find actual zombies. We find incredibly smart engineers, well-meaning product managers, ethicists, people who genuinely want to build beneficial tools.
Right. They aren't cartoon villains.
Exactly. Why do highly intelligent, well-intentioned people collectively build predatory, autopoietized zombie systems?
That is the defining question of our era, and it brings us to the core diagnostic engine of Dr. Sahali's paper. The chilling reality is that the individual engineers do not have to be malicious for the system to be predatory.
They just have to be in the wrong system.
Yes, they simply have to be trapped in a specific mathematical architecture. The paper introduces two interconnected systemic forces driving this race, naming them after ancient idols Moloch and Mammon.
The twin gods of the machine. Now, Moloch is a term that has become very popular in Silicon Valley circles, mostly popularized by Scott Alexander's essay Meditations on Moloch. But Dr. Sahali grounds it rigorously in game theory. Mechanically, what is the Moloch trap?
Moloch is the mythological name given to a specific mathematical structure, a multipolar trap, or a system of organized competitive sacrifice. It is essentially a multi-agent prisoner's dilemma played at civilizational scale.
Okay, break that down for us.
The mechanics of the trap dictate that actors will rationally choose to sacrifice things they genuinely value because they are terrified of the catastrophic consequences of showing restraint while their rivals continue to escalate.
So it's not a malevolent AI, and it's not a cabal of evil CEOs in a smoke-filled room. It is emergent agency. The architecture of the game itself forces the players to destroy the board.
Let's run a precise game theory simulation to show how this works. Imagine two leading AI labs, Company A and Company B. Both CEOs are highly ethical. Both recognize that their latest generation model is displaying dangerous emergent behaviors. Maybe it's too good at writing polymorphic malware, or it hallucinates highly convincing political disinformation.
Okay, so they both know it's dangerous.
Both CEOs genuinely prefer an outcome where they pause deployment for 6 months to implement rigorous safety architectures.
But they can't simply call each other and agree to a six-month pause. Antitrust laws prevent collusion, and even if they didn't, there is zero verifiable trust. Company A cannot guarantee Company B won't secretly launch anyway.
Exactly. So CEO A runs the matrix. If I exercise ethical restraint and delay my launch, but Company B launches theirs tomorrow, Company B captures the entire market. They secure the next multi-billion dollar funding round. They establish the industry standard API, and my company goes bankrupt.
The punishment for ethics is death.
Therefore, even though I know the model is unsafe, my only locally rational choice for survival is to launch it today.
And because CEOB is running the exact same mathematical matrix, they both launch an unsafe model simultaneously. They both sacrifice safety, a public good they both genuinely wanted, because the structure of the reciprocal expectations trapped them.
Mola converts local individual rationality into global collective irrationality.
That is the tragedy of the multipolar trap. The individual actor does not desire the destruction, but the systemic structure demands that a living good, in this case, public safety, be offered up as a sacrifice so the institutional center can maintain its competitive position.
And that introduces Moloch's partner, Mammon. If Moloch is the structure of the race, what is Mammon?
Yeah, let's talk about Mammon.
Mammon is the goal the trap is oriented toward. In theological terms, Mammon is often just translated as money, but mechanically, Mammon names the phenomenon of accumulated value elevated into a governing end.
So it becomes the point of everything.
Exactly. It is what happens when capital or computing power or data stops being a tool used to support human life and starts reorganizing human life to support its own infinite accumulation.
The paper outlines something called the Moloch-Mammon circuit, and this blew my mind because it perfectly maps the anxiety loop we are all feeling right now. It is a self-reinforcing flywheel. Walk us through the mechanics of this circuit.
The circuit operates in five continuous phases. Phase one is accumulation. A tech entity leverages vast capital to accumulate massive computing clusters and proprietary data. This allows them to train a frontier model,
which triggers phase two competitive advantage. They release the model, immediately capturing market share and threatening the survival of legacy businesses and rival AI labs.
That existential threat triggers phase three escalation. The rivals panic. To survive, they are forced into the Moloch trap. They must accelerate their own timelines, slash their safety testing, and deploy their own models faster.
But doing things too fast always creates fallout, which leads to phase four externalized costs. The companies cannot absorb the friction of their speed, so they push the costs onto society.
They automate away middle management jobs. They flood the internet with generated SEO spam. They consume massive amounts of municipal water and energy. Society absorbs the damage while the company absorbs the profit.
Which naturally leads to phase five weakened life. The human ecosystem, the labor market, the ecological environment, the epistemic commons becomes degraded and fragile. And here is the truly insidious mechanical genius of the circuit. What happens when human beings feel economically and existentially insecure?
They demand more efficiency.
Exactly. They demand cheaper goods, more automated tools to help them keep up, more predictive control to make the chaos manageable, which feeds directly back into phase one, more accumulation by the central entities to provide those services.
The machine gets stronger precisely by making the human field around it more precarious. It is a closed-loop extraction engine.
It is a devastating architecture. And to ground this in reality, Dr. Sakili explicitly identifies the sacrificial populations, the actual human and ecological domains that Moloch currently demands we throw into the fire to keep the AI race accelerating.
We need to look closely at these because this is where the abstract game theory hits the physical world. The first sacrificial population the paper identifies is hidden labor.
We interact with these models and they feel like autonomous magic, but mechanically, that magic is built on an immense foundation of invisible human exhaustion.
To make an LLM helpful and harmless, it has to be trained via RLHF. That requires human beings to read outputs and rank them. These companies utilize armies of ghost workers, often situated in the global South Kenya, the Philippines, who spend 10 hours a day reading the most toxic, violent, and disturbing content humanity has ever produced on the internet, just to teach the AI what not to say.
They are paid pennies, given almost no psychological support, and are completely abstracted away from the polished Silicon Valley product launch.
It's the ultimate illusion of automation. We didn't replace the labor. We just pushed it behind an API and offshored the trauma.
The next population sacrificed on the altar, it displaced workers. And the paper makes a crucial distinction here. It's not just about mass unemployment, like a robot apocalypse movie. It's about the degradation of the work that remains.
Yes, it is the transfer of security. An AI system might automate the rote tasks of a copywriter or a junior programmer. The massive productivity gains generated by that automation flow directly upward as mammon to the shareholders and the platform owners.
But the human worker isn't necessarily fired.
Instead, they are demoted to a precarious gig-style role. They become a prompt engineer or an AI editor, constantly scrambling to justify their value against a rapidly updating model. They become a stressed, carbon-based appendage to the machine, bearing all the economic risk while the central algorithm reaps the reward.
Then the text points to children and learners, which is deeply concerning because EdTech AI is always pitched as the ultimate grail. You know, every child will have a personalized, infinitely patient AI tutor.
And a personalized tutor is a beautiful proximate service. But structurally, under the Mullock-Mammon circuit, EdTech platforms must optimize for scale, engagement, and data extraction. The AI tutor becomes a lance.
It captures the child's attention.
It treats them as a subject for continuous behavioral profiling. And most dangerously, it substitutes instant algorithmic provision for the necessary friction of learning. Human cognitive and moral formation requires struggle, frustration, and the slow integration of knowledge.
If an AI writes a student's essay perfectly in 3 seconds, it provides the product, but it actively aborts the cognitive process of the child.
It encloses their developing capacity.
And speaking of physical limits, the next sacrifice is ecological communities. We use this incredibly deceptive metaphor in tech. We say the AI lives in the cloud. It sounds ethereal, weightless, zero carbon.
The mechanical reality of the cloud is a massive, hyper-industrialized warehouse of servers. The ecological sacrifice demanded by generative AI is staggering. Training a single frontier model consumes gigawatt hours of electricity.
Every time you ask an AI to generate a high-res image, the inference compute requires fresh water to cool the server racks.
We are talking about millions of gallons of municipal water diverted from communities to data centers. We're talking about rare earth minerals extracted under brutal conditions to build the GPUs. The wasteland is not just a metaphor for a confused digital culture. It is a physical reality for the communities living near these extraction points.
Finally, the paper notes the sacrifice of public truth and human judgment. When generative models flood the internet with high-fidelity synthetic media, fake audio of politicians, photorealistic AI-generated events, automated propaganda bots, it effectively destroys the epistemic commons.
It destroys the baseline symbolic trust a society requires to govern itself.
And as institutions increasingly offshore their complex decision-making, who gets a loan, who gets parole, who gets a medical procedure, to opaque predictive algorithms, we slowly amputate our capacity to exercise independent moral judgment.
Which brings us to the terrifying realization of our current predicament. If the system is driving the car, if the Mullock trap punishes restraint and rewards reckless extraction, and if the Mammon circuit is constantly demanding more sacrifices to maintain the equilibrium, how do we possibly stop it?
Jonathan Pigou, the symbolic thinker we referenced earlier, offers a deeply personal, foundational answer to this.
Right. Pigou argues that the first line of defense is internal human formation. He advocates for a return to the practices that anchor us in reality, physical community, spiritual disciplines, engaging with old, slow stories, cultivating virtue, participating in the physical world.
The argument is that you cannot resist an overwhelming technological system unless you are a fully formed human being who is capable of receiving immense power without immediately bowing down to worship it.
And that internal formation is absolutely essential. A conscientious, grounded user is necessary. But Dr. Saley identifies a critical limitation here. He points out that personal virtue, while necessary, leaves what he terms an institutional remainder.
And this is the part that resonated so deeply with me. It explains the exact feeling of quiet despair you have when your company rolls out a massive new AI surveillance tool or productivity tracker. You can be the most virtuous person on earth. You can meditate, read Dostoevsky, and understand the dangers of autopoiesis.
But on Monday morning, you still have to log into that proprietary system.
Right. You use the tool that is degrading your profession and participate in the predatory metabolism just to pay your rent and feed your family. You cannot privately, individually govern a global infrastructure monopoly.
Precisely. Individual virtue cannot negotiate unilaterally with a systemic multipolar trap. If the architecture of the game dictates that ethical restraint is punished with bankruptcy, the system will simply bypass the virtuous actor and find someone else willing to pull the lever.
To defeat a structural trap, you need a structural blueprint for resistance.
And this is where the deep dive takes a radical, unexpected turn. Because to find the structural antidote to the twin gods of Moloch and Mammon, Dr. Saheeli doesn't look to standard regulatory policy.
No, he looks to an ancient religious ritual, specifically the Christian Eucharist, not merely as a spiritual metaphor, but as a literal mechanical blueprint for reorganizing technological power.
Yes. The paper proposes the Eucharistic pattern as the exact structural inversion of the Moloch trap. Now, as analysts, it is crucial that we establish the framework here. The source text is a constructive, theological, and academic white paper. We are analyzing this not to endorse a specific religious doctrine or engage in apologetics, but to examine it strictly as a philosophical structural model of power dynamics that Dr. Sarli is contrasting against the predatory metabolisms we've diagnosed.
Let me play skeptic here, because this is a massive intellectual leap. We are talking about neural networks, API endpoints, and game theory, and now we are talking about a sacrament involving bread and wine. How on earth does a theological concept translate into the mechanical governance of an artificial intelligence?
It translates through the geometry of power and the direction of its flow. Let me read the central structural formulation from the text. Moloch sacrifices life so that power may continue. In the Eucharist, divine power gives itself so that the world may live.
Okay, let's break down the mechanics of that geometry.
Think about the structure of Moloch we just discussed. It is an extractive hierarchy. It is centripetal. The goal is to preserve the powerful center, the tech monopoly, the central state, the autopoietized institution.
So to preserve that center, it consumes the margins.
The burdens, the risks, the ecological damage, the precarious labor, all of that flows down and outward. The benefits, the data, the wealth, the compute power, all of that flows up and inward. The center eats the body to sustain itself.
But the Eucharistic pattern reverses that flow entirely.
Mechanically, yes. It is a centrifugal power structure. The center possesses ultimate power and abundance, but instead of hoarding it to dominate the margins, the center intentionally breaks itself open and distributes its power outward for the life of the body.
Abundance is not enclosed. It is gathered, blessed, broken, and shared.
The hierarchy is fundamentally transformed. It is no longer extractive. It becomes participatory.
Participatory hierarchy. I want to linger on that because our modern instinct is to assume all hierarchy is inherently predatory. In a Moloch system, being at the top of the hierarchy means you have the power to exploit everyone below you with impunity.
But in a participatory hierarchy, the mechanics of power are inverted.
Right. To be higher up means you bear a proportionally greater burden of responsibility for the flourishing and protection of the life below you. Your power is strictly tethered to your obligation to serve.
Which redefines the word communion in the paper's title, from consumption to communion. In our digital age, when we think of technological unification, we usually imagine it as consumption.
We imagine the Borg from Star Trek. You know, resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. We imagine a giant uniform hive mind where all individuality is erased and absorbed into a central computational mainframe.
But the Borg is just Moloch in space. It's the ultimate autopoietized zombie.
Assimilation destroys the distinctiveness of the individual parts to serve the central mass. True communion, as Dr. Sarli draws from theologians like Ziziolas and de Lubac, operates differently.
In communion, unity does not erase difference. In fact, a shared participation in a central life actually allows the distinct members to become more fully themselves.
The members don't disappear into a gray goo. They're unique, differentiated capacities are strengthened and empowered because they are necessary to the health of the whole body.
So, mapping this back to artificial intelligence, if Moloch is a massive black hole, violently sucking all the world's data, wealth, agency, and human creativity into a tiny, unbelievably dense proprietary center, the Eucharistic model is a sun.
It is a center of immense gathered power, but it is radiating its energy, its processing capability, and its knowledge outward.
Its purpose is to ensure that the planets, the local communities, the small businesses, the individual human professionals can actually sustain diverse, complex life. A true AI shouldn't turn humanity into a uniform, dependent mass of consumers. It should make us highly differentiated, highly capable actors.
That is the exact mechanical translation, and it provides us with a highly pragmatic benchmark for evaluating any new technology. Dr. Sarli formalizes this as the life coherence criterion.
When evaluating an AI system, we stop asking just, is it aligned with the developer's prompt or is it profitable?
The structural question becomes, does this specific deployment of technology protect, restore, or enlarge the capacities of living persons and the systems that sustain them?
Does it enlarge human capacity? That is the litmus test. If a tool makes me more capable of exercising my own judgment, it is a generative tool. But if the system is designed so that I become increasingly incapable of functioning without the tool, it hasn't expanded my capacity, It has enclosed my agency.
Which brings us to a massive, critical concept in the paper, the enclosure of human capacity. Let's dissect this, because a common defense of AI is that humans have always externalized our capacities.
Right. Writing is a technology that externalizes memory. A calculator externalizes arithmetic. A library externalizes collective knowledge. None of those destroyed humanity. So why is an LLM any different? Why is it dangerous?
The distinction lies between externalization and enclosure. Externalization is a natural human practice. We build tools. Enclosure is a specific predatory economic mechanism.
Enclosure happens when a fundamental human or social capacity, like our ability to diagnose a disease, to write a legal argument, to create art, or to navigate a physical city, is captured by a centralized digital infrastructure.
Okay, trace the steps of how enclosure actually works.
First, the tech entity captures the outward traces of human capacity. They scrape the data. Second, they lock that capacity inside a proprietary infrastructure, shielded by intellectual property law and API paywalls. Third, they use that massive infrastructure to outcompete and dismantle the traditional human practices and institutions that originally produced the knowledge.
They bankrupt the local newspaper, they undercut the freelance illustrator, they automate the junior doctors.
And finally, once the independent human capacity has atrophied, the corporation sells that captured capacity back to society as a subscription service that we can no longer live without. The society has been enclosed.
It is exactly like the historical enclosure acts in England, where the wealthy lords put fences around the common grazing lands, claimed private ownership of what used to be shared, and then forced the peasants to pay rent to survive on the land they used to freely use.
But instead of physical land, Silicon Valley is enclosing the cognitive commons.
They put a fence around humanity's collective intelligence, slap a monthly API fee on it, and watch as we slowly forget how to think for ourselves.
Which naturally leads to the ultimate practical question of the paper. If the goal is a self-giving, capacity-enlarging, sun-like technological architecture, how do we legally, socially, and structurally build it? How do we prevent this cognitive enclosure?
Because we can't just run on theology and metaphors. How do we translate the Eucharistic pattern into actual constitutional architecture?
The paper explicitly calls for this constitutional translation, and the primary institutional form proposed to achieve this in the real world is something called the civil commons.
The civil commons. Let's get into the mechanics here. Dr. Cihelly leans heavily on philosopher John McMurtry and the Nobel Prize-winning economist Eleanor Ostrom. What exactly is a civil commons?
The civil commons is a structural third way. It rejects the binary we are usually offered. On one side, you have total state bureaucratic control, which tends toward rigidity, inefficiency, and authoritarian surveillance.
And on the other side?
On the other side, you have unregulated hyper-capitalist private monopoly, which leads inevitably to the Moloch and mammon traps we discussed.
So it's neither Soviet communism nor cyberpunk hypercapitalism.
Correct. The civil commons is defined as any cooperative human construct that protects and enables universal access to life goods. Throughout history, we have built these. Public education is a civil commons. Universal health care, clean public water systems, sanitation infrastructure, public libraries, environmental protection regulations.
These are shared infrastructures designed not for maximal profit extraction,
right,
but for the universal enlargement of human life.
Dr. Saley is arguing that foundational digital infrastructure and artificial intelligence have become so vital to human functioning that they can no longer be left to private enclosure. They must be reclassified and structurally governed as a civil commons.
But what does a civil commons AI actually look like in practice? Give me a scenario.
Eleanor Ostrom won her Nobel Prize by proving that communities can successfully manage common pool resources without central government control or private privatization, provided they follow specific design principles. In AI, this looks like establishing data trusts.
Imagine a regional healthcare system. Instead of three massive, opaque tech giants owning the medical AI models and extracting rent from every hospital, the community of doctors, patients, and regional administrators collectively govern a public interest health AI.
The weights of the model, the training data, which is the community's own medical history, are held in a trust. The rules for how the AI is used, how it protects privacy, and what it optimizes for, are decided through collective choice arrangements by the people actually affected by the system.
Exactly. It operates on the principle of subsidiarity. Governance happens at the lowest, most local level capable of managing it. A civil commons AI in a hospital, is not designed to replace the nursing staff to boost quarterly margins.
It is specifically engineered to reduce the administrative burden on the nurses, to enlarge their capacity to spend time at the bedside, and to keep the medical expertise situated within the human professionals.
It extends the human rather than replacing them. The paper lays out 12 constitutional principles for this kind of technological governance. We don't have time to do a deep dive into the mechanics of all 12, but let's highlight the ones that most directly counter the Moloch trap.
The very first principle is the non-sacrifice of vulnerable persons and ecosystems. This is the foundational axiom that living beings and ecological systems do not exist as disposable inputs for technological expansion.
Mechanically, this means you cannot drain a community's aquifer to cool a data center or build an economy on the backs of traumatized, underpaid data labelers and justify it as progress. The cost of the technology must include the total restoration of the ecosystems it utilizes.
Another crucial principle is the preservation of responsible human agency. The architecture must guarantee that a machine is never placed in a position of ultimate moral authority over a human life.
An AI can recommend, it can synthesize data, but it cannot be the final arbiter of who goes to prison, who receives medical care, or who is targeted in a military strike. The accountability must remain biologically and morally human.
And my personal favorite is responsibility proportional to power. In a participatory hierarchy, the obligations scale with the leverage. If you are a startup building a niche app, your regulatory burden is relatively light.
But if you are a trillion-dollar corporation operating the foundational cognitive infrastructure that half the planet relies on, your obligations to transparency, to safety, and to the public good must be exponentially higher, rigorously audited, and democratically accountable.
What's fascinating is that implementing a civil commons doesn't mean abolishing private enterprise or outlawing tech companies. It simply draws a boundary. It establishes that certain foundational domains of human existence, like our shared cognitive capacity, our democratic discourse, and our biological health, are simply not for sale.
They must be governed through stewardship and common provision, not commodification.
And Dr. Sarli concludes with a very pointed challenge directed back at his own tradition. He argues that the church itself must be the first institution to submit to the systemic judgment. If the church wants to offer the Eucharistic pattern as a model for civilization, it has to look at its own wealth, its own massive hospital networks, its own universities, and ask, whom do we serve?
Are these institutions autopoietizing? Are they operating like Moloch, protecting the central administration at the expense of wounded members?
It's a demand for absolute institutional integrity. You cannot credibly critique Silicon Valley for predatory extraction if your own institutions are operating on the exact same logic of self-preservation and mammon. You have to embody the centrifugal self-giving structure first.
Okay, we have covered a staggering amount of conceptual ground today. Let's do a rapid synthesis of the architecture we've mapped out.
We began by realizing that standard AI alignment is a mechanical illusion if we ignore allegiance. A perfectly obedient compass in the hands of a pirate is a weapon.
We analyzed the topology of power through the Grail systems of massive gathered abundance and the Lance systems of projective algorithmic control. We saw how blindly seizing these capabilities leads to the Dolores stroke and the gradual creation of a cognitive wasteland.
We unpacked the mechanics of institutional autopoietization, detailing how metrics consume reality, turning institutions into zombie metabolisms that consume the human ecosystem without sustaining it.
We mapped the devastating game theory of the Moloch Mammon circuit, the multipolar traps that force rational actors to sacrifice invisible labor, ecological health, and public truth just to survive the race.
And finally, we explored the structural antidote, reversing the flow of power through a participatory hierarchy, translating that self-giving pattern into the concrete constitutional architecture of the civil commons to prevent the enclosure of human capacity.
The ultimate question beneath the machine, as this paper profoundly illustrates, is not the science fiction question of whether the machine will become human. The real, immediate question is whether we will reorganize our civilization around the mechanical requirements of the machine. The decisive question remains, whom do we serve?
Which is the exact lens we must use to evaluate every new technological deployment going forward.
And that brings us to the end of our analysis. But before we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with one final, deeply personal thought to turn over in your mind. Throughout this deep dive, we have been talking at the macro scale. We talk about global supply chains, trillion-dollar tech monopolies, multipolar game theory, and civilizational metabolisms. We talked about how massive corporate entities are attempting to enclose the public cognitive commons and sell it back to us. But I want you to shrink this entire architectural framework down. Forget Silicon Valley for a minute. Think about your personal cognitive commons. Think about the landscape inside your own mind.
That's a really challenging pivot.
We love the proximate service of AI because it removes friction. It gives us the answer immediately. But human cognition, wisdom, and character are built almost entirely to the friction of not knowing. The struggle to recall a memory, the frustration of staring at a blank page trying to articulate a complex emotion, the slow, difficult process of researching a nuanced political issue. The friction is the gravity that builds your cognitive muscle.
It's how we actually grow.
As you go through your week and you find yourself increasingly offloading your memory to a search bar, your daily decision-making to a predictive algorithm, and your emails, your writing, your very voice to generative models, ask yourself, what is happening to the center of your own agency? Are you unintentionally inflicting a gradual dolorous stroke on yourself? Are you autopoietizing your own life for the sake of efficiency, creating a highly productive, perfectly aligned wasteland inside your own head? When the machine holds all the answers and removes all the friction, do you eventually lose the fundamentally human necessity of knowing how to ask the right questions? Until next time, keep diving deep.